This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
Any regular listener to the Tom Hartman Program has heard the exchange. Caller, Tom, how are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better.
Well, today I'm sorry to report to you, Tom Hartman is not so great, but he's getting better. He picked up a bug of some sort on his whirlwind travels to Darfur last week, and he's at home resting. We wish him all the best, and do it however you like. Light a candle, say a prayer, or just give him your best wishes. And hopefully he'll be back with you on Monday. Once again, sitting in for Tom Hartman, I'm Peter B. Collins from San Francisco. I'm back at my home base. I enjoyed 2 days of coverage here on the program, Monday and Tuesday this week, live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. And I'm delighted to be back under difficult circumstances for Tom. But the show must go on. It shall. We're absolutely live here today. Brunch with Bernie is serving up next, and you can call in to talk with the senator at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. Later on the program today, Dr. Lawrence Yun, who is chief economist and senior VP for the National Association of Realtors, will give his views on the mortgage meltdown and, most importantly, the impact on working families and, you know, people who occupy, owner-occupied homes. What are we going to do to make sure that the crunch on Wall Street doesn't squeeze working families out of their homes? That's my top priority. And in our third hour today, Jeff Charlotte, who writes for Harper's and Rolling Stone, has a new book coming out, and in it is a description of Hillary Clinton's involvement with a prayer group in Washington that is populated by some of the most extreme evangelicals in government or politics these days. We'll tell you about that story. It's all ahead here on the Tom Hartman Program. If you want to drop me an email, you can do so, peter@peterbcollins.com. Senator Bernie Sanders is the very independent senator from the great state of Vermont. Bernie, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program today.
Nice to be with you, Peter, and let me give my best wishes to Tom as well and hope he is rapidly on the road to recovery.
Indeed. I have a great love for the Green Mountain State. My grandfather came from Burlington, had a house on South Winooski Avenue, and I've spent a fair amount of time in Vermont, but I could never claim to be a resident because I've never survived a winter there.
Well, I am talking to you from Burlington. I used to be the mayor of the city from 1981 to 89, and it is a great city and a great state, and we'd love listeners to come on up and taste a little bit of Vermont.
Now, you've been a controversial figure. You describe yourself as a socialist, a democratic socialist, and you've always been a very independent, 8 terms in Congress as an independent, and now in your first term in the United States Senate. Has anyone ever questioned your religious values and your association with a rabbi or other religious figure and tried to, in some way, denigrate you by associating you with comments of that religious figure?
Well, Peter, I've been attacked in many ways for many years, but not in that particular way. And I think Barack Obama the other day in his speech on race made a very good point. And the point is that every election there are those people, often in the right wing, who will use every trick in the trade to deflect attention away from the most important issues facing the American people and an analysis of what candidates will do to address those problems. That's what politics is about. And what happens is year after year, we find a deflection away from that aspect of life, and we look at little issues. Now, the truth of the matter is Obama's minister is not running for president of the United States. Barack Obama is. The truth of the matter is that if we elect Mr. McCain to be president, by and large, whether John McCain's a nice guy or not a nice guy, I think he's a nice guy, he certainly was a war hero, you are looking at 4 more years of the Bush agenda in terms of Iraq, in terms of tax policy, in terms of trade policy. Is that where you want America to go? So it seems to me we should be looking about at what is going on in this country in terms of our economy, which under Bush has seen poverty increasing, Median family income declining, 8 million people losing their health insurance, 3 million people losing their pension. Cost of a gallon of gas right now in the state of Vermont is about $3.20 to fill up your tank. Cost of home heating oil is over $4 a gallon. Our people are losing their vacation time. We have a major crisis facing the middle class, while the gap between the very, very rich and everybody else is growing wider, because the wealthiest people have not had it so good since the 1920s. Now, it seems to me those are the issues that we should be focusing on. But the reason that Fox Television and our right-wing friends don't want us to focus on those issues is the same old story. They want to deflect our attention to race, to gender, to guns, to whatever it may be, so that working people vote against their basic interest. And I think what we have got to do, understanding that honest people have honest differences of opinion, we have got to sit down, analyze what's wrong with America, and analyze and figure out how we go forward to create a country which protects the middle class, which provides the educational opportunity our kids need, health care for all, a trade policy that works for average people rather than CEOs of large corporations. How do we address the very serious problem of global warming at the same time as we create millions of good-paying jobs, transforming our energy system away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency and sustainable energy? Tremendous challenges facing this country. Can we solve them? You bet we can. But we're not going to solve them if we're sitting around worrying about Barack Obama's minister or Hillary Clinton's hairdo or whatever else it may be. We've got to look at the issues, have the debate about how we go forward, and understand that the vast majority of the American people are on the same side. They want a better life for their kids, and that's what I think we got to do.
And Senator Obama's powerful speech in Philadelphia on Tuesday, I think, made a deep impact. But and John Stewart is credited with this description, that he spoke to Americans about race as adults. And that's a very important point to make. But he also had a challenge to the media built into that speech, saying, you know, you can replay these clips and just distract us with this all the way till November, or you can allow us to have an honest dialogue with the American people. But as I mentioned, we're going to talk a little bit later about Hillary's prayer group. The New York Times has a photograph of Bill Clinton with Jeremiah Wright at a prayer breakfast in 98, just as the Star report was being released. John Hagee has gone public saying that John McCain indeed asked him for an endorsement. And so it seems like we're going to get caught up in Preachergate and not be able to really focus on
the political issues. But it's not just Preachergate. And I am not as optimistic about Obama that the media will, in fact, do the right thing. I think if you look at politics today, it is a combination of reporting on the Super Bowl. In fact, if you sometimes look at primary results, they call it the voter bowl. In other words, it takes a look at politics the way we would at the Super Bowl or the NCAA Final Four, and also a combination of the American Idol. And that is, we look at personality and quirks and grandmothers and preachers and this, that, and the other thing, rather than taking a hard look at the reality of American life and how we can improve our society. And you know,
Congressman,
that raises the whole question of media in general, who owns media, the growing concentration of ownership in media, the fact that major newspapers have cut back on their investigative reporting capabilities, and it becomes cheaper and easier just to deal with media gossip, polling, and Barack Obama's minister, rather than what is our trade policy doing to America? What does it mean that we have a huge trade deficit or national debt of over $9 trillion? Which candidate is serious about addressing those issues? That's hard stuff. You need people who understand a little bit about economics. Much easier to be talking about Barack Obama's minister.
So, Senator Sanders, let me focus on what I think is the critical issue of the moment. How can we re-regulate our financial institutions to protect bankers from their own greed? And how can we protect consumers, particularly working families, from the fallout caused by greedy bankers?
Well, that is a very important question. I used to be on the Financial Services Committee when I was in the House. I'm not on the Banking Committee in the Senate, so I haven't been dealing with this on a day-to-day basis. But the basic premise of your statement is absolutely right. What has happened over the years is we've deregulated banking, the banking industry. So right now you can have bankers and subprime lenders ripping off people, giving them loans that in many instances they understand can never be paid back with calamitous results. You have, in terms of the deregulation, credit card companies now charging people 25-30% interest on their credit cards, even when they pay their debts back on time. This is an issue we can discuss it in a moment, but this is certainly an issue that Congress has to address.
We'll pick up there as we continue. The phone lines are jammed. When somebody hangs up, call in toll-free at 866-303-2270. Email me, Peter, at peterbcollins.com. Tom Hartman is recuperating, hopes to rejoin you on Monday. From San Francisco, I'm Peter B. Collins. Glad to be sitting in on the Tom Hartman program.
Tom Hartman. Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman program.
Barack Obama, campaigning in Oregon today, is expected to receive the endorsement of his former challenger for the Democratic nomination, Governor Bill Richardson of New Mexico. We'll bring you more on that a little bit later on the Tom Hartman program. Sitting in for Tom today, I'm Peter B. Collins, but the brunch with Bernie goes on. And Senator Sanders, I wanted to ask you about the Glass-Steagall Act, which was generally repealed, and Bill Clinton signed that measure in 1998. Many people believe that that's what took down the firewall between the banks that are insured by the FDIC and regulated by the Federal Reserve and the investment banks, which are closer to casinos on Wall Street.
That's right. And I voted against that for that reason. It seems to me to be a very bad idea to put the taxpayers at risk insuring an increasingly deregulated conglomerate industry, and I think that that was a bad idea and creates this too big to fail scenario by which you're screwed if you do and you're screwed if you don't. And you know, that's one of the areas I think in Congress we're going to have to take a very hard look at.
Here's an email from Vic. Ask Senator Sanders, is the Fed bailout of banks a loan? It appears that the solution to the borrowing frenzy is to borrow more money. The Fed is creating money out of thin air, printing a $100 bill for 6 cents and then loaning it to whomever at interest, which they have to work or sell a product for. Then it goes into gibberish here, but you get his point.
Well, I get the point. And the point is that our national debt is now at $9.2 trillion. It's going to be at $10 trillion. This is a debt that's having just horrendous impacts on our economy, not to mention the moral issues of leaving that debt to our kids and our grandchildren. It's one of the reasons that our dollar is declining. With the dollar declining, we're paying more for oil in this country. So the caller makes a very important point.
Let's go to McCain country. It's Carol in Mesa, Arizona. Welcome, Carol. You're on Brunch with Bernie.
Good morning. Everybody with any political awareness knows they're going to steal or try to steal this next election. Is there some way the Senate could get some money? I don't care what you have to attach it to make sure every state has enough money to use paper ballots that are traceable.
Well, let me respond in two ways, Carol. Number one, let's not get too paranoid about the issue. In the last election, the three closest Senate races were, and they were quite close, were won by Democrats, not Republicans. Second of all, I happen to agree that so long as there remains concerns about the integrity of touchscreen balloting, that we should move, in fact, to other forms such as paper ballots. I'd rather wait a few hours more to get results, but know that those results are accurate. You are seeing now all over this country secretaries of state, including Republican secretaries of state, who are moving in that direction as well.
All right. Thank you very much, Carol. To Bob in Tacoma, Washington. Welcome, Bob. You're on the Tom Hartman program with Senator Sanders.
Mr. Sanders, I just want to thank you so very much for being who you are and what you're doing.
Thank you, Bob.
I also wanted to say that it's not only the right wing that's using the deflection ideas in this campaign. Bill and Hillary are pros at it, and they're being divisive, vindictive, mm-hmm. deceitful, and I was wondering why in the world more Democrats like yourself don't come out and point out that we don't want this kind of race and talk to Bill and Hillary and say, you know, you guys are really ruining this whole thing. You're damaging Barack Obama on purpose so that he will not be able to stand against McCain, because McCain, it seems like, and the Clintons are working together, and I don't know what this deal is with him being a war hero. He was dropping bombs on innocent men, women, and children in Vietnam, thousands of feet, and got caught at it.
All right, Bob, I got the point. You raised a number of issues, and I think the first one is more important than the second one. This guy was held captive for 5 years and was tortured, and I think we respect people who have gone through that process, no matter what one's views of the Vietnam War were, and I was opposed to the Vietnam War. But anyone who goes through what he went through is worthy of respect. But your first point, I think, is a very important point. And I should tell you, Bob, that there are a lot of people who are demanding that within the Democratic primary that Obama and Clinton debate issues, that they not engender personal attacks. And there is a lot of concern about what the Clinton camp is doing in trying to undermine Obama. The truth of the matter is that Clinton's views and Obama's views pretty much are alike. I mean, the media may try to make them look quite different, but they're not. They're both moderate to liberal Democrats. I think they have a right to go out, make their points of view, criticize the other people on policy issues, but we do not want to fall into the Republican trap so that the Republicans are laughing all the way to the bank by these guys chew themselves up. But your point about the Clinton campaign, I think, is a right point, and some of us are trying to do what we can to make sure that they don't eat each other up so that they fall to the Republicans.
And a clarification for Bob, Senator Sanders is an independent. He is
right.
Not a member of
the Democratic Party. And what I have said, just so listeners know that, as an independent, I have not been involved in the Democratic primary. But what I will do is the day after the candidate is selected, will do everything that I can to see that that person is elected president.
All right, let's get a quick comment from Harvey in Berkeley, listening on one of my favorite stations, Green 960 in San Francisco. Harvey?
Hi, Peter B. And hi, Bernie Saunders. I want to thank you both for the work you're doing to slow down global warming. And I have a couple of great... I have two things I want to say about solar energy. One is a new bill that's being introduced into the California state legislature. And you can Google this. It's Assembly Bill 1920, AB 1920. Put that words into it. And it'll let you produce as much solar energy. Now, you're only allowed to produce as much solar energy to cover your own bill. But this way, you can put as many solar panels on your roof and sell.
All right,
the
Harvey,
power.
I'm sorry, we're up against a break here. Thank you for your call from Berkeley, where solar power has some very special financing plans, too. This is the Tom Hartman Program. It's Brunch with Bernie.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
The Tom Hartman Program continues. It's our weekly Brunch with Bernie. Tom is recuperating and hopes to be back with you on Monday. I'm Peter B. Collins in San Francisco. Senator Sanders, this week was a kind of awkward monitoring or remembrance of the fifth-year anniversary of the invasion of Iraq and the continuing occupation. And first, Dick Cheney went to Baghdad and used terms like phenomenal to describe the progress that he wants us to believe. And the president used the Pentagon as a photo op once again to deliver an upbeat speech that was really only missing the mission accomplished banner that they prematurely posted back in 2003. And I just want to get your thoughts on what the best way forward is to end the occupation and bring our troops home. And does all this have to wait for the election of a new president and a new Congress?
Well, tell you what, let it wait for 1 second, because I want to get back to Harvey's question.
Okay.
Dealing with solar energy in California. And he made a very important point, and that is, I would hope the listeners understand that the potential for solar, the potential for wind, the potential for energy efficiency in this country is enormous. And as we transform our energy system, we can create millions of good-paying jobs. Right now, in California, they have a plan to put 1 million rooftops of photovoltaics up within the next 10 years. They are working in California on a solar thermal unit which will produce enough electricity from the sun for 400,000 homes at a reasonable price. And there are people who believe that in the Southwest, California, Nevada, New Mexico, Arizona, we have the potential through solar thermal plants to provide one-third of the electricity that the United States needs. So there are tremendous opportunities, not only in combating global warming, but cleaning up our environment and creating good-paying jobs. I wanted to make that point. In terms of Iraq, you're quite right, Peter. It is forever beyond comprehension that we have a vice president in a president who was so out of touch with reality. We had a, these folks were the people who told us that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. They were wrong. They told us that Iraq was linked to Al-Qaeda. They were wrong. They told us that this war would be over quickly. They were wrong. They told us it would be inexpensive and paid for by Iraqi oil. They were wrong. And now, as we spend $12 billion a month, $150 billion a year, above and beyond the $515 billion military budget, they have no plan, zero, nothing, to end this war, which has resulted in our losing our focus in fighting Al-Qaeda and international terrorism. Is this problem going to be solved while Bush is president? Of course it's not. His goal from the very beginning was to leave the problem to his predecessor, to his successor, and that's the way it will be. But I hope the American people and the Congress will move boldly to say this war has got to end. We've got to bring our troops home. I don't think you can bring them home tomorrow, but you can start withdrawing within a couple of months, bring them all home, certainly less than a year. We have to continue, I think, to support the Iraqi military and their government, try to bring stability there. But for 5 years, we have paid an awful price in terms of death, in terms of injury, in terms of money. It is time for the Iraqi people to get their act together and to make the political agreements that they have got to make.
Let's go to Tom in Norwich, Connecticut. Hello, Tom. You're on the Tom Hartman program with Senator Sanders.
Yes, hello. Senator Sanders, I want to thank you for the work that you do in the Senate. You're one of the few people that actually stand up to the Republican clowns. I wanted to find out from you, because I know you were pretty vocal about it there, about the stimulus package thing and getting poor people to also be able to have partake in it. And I get disability payments on the Social Security, and I've heard a number of different stories, and so I figured I'd talk to somebody that knows you. Are people that are on Social Security disability payments, are they going to be eligible to receive stimulus payment? I mean, especially with prices going up and it gets difficult to buy food and things like that, will we be seeing any help?
You know, Tom, that is a good, my assumption is, I should know this, and I apologize, I think you will. I mean, I think what happened is in the House, what was passed was a stimulus package limited to working families. What we did is expand it to over 20 million people on Social Security and 250,000 disabled veterans. I am assuming that I should have known this, and I apologize, that this will include people on SSI.
Because I'll tell
right,
you
Tom.
What.
Because
go ahead,
the goal
Tom.
Of the program is to get this money into the hands of people who need it, who will spend it, who will create jobs, and that's certainly
right.
People within the disability community.
Okay, Tom, thank you very much for the call today. And, Senator, let me weigh in here on the FISA bill. I really strongly support the better version that has come out of the House, and I am very pleased that they have stood firm, not allowed the president to intimidate them and mislead them into allowing amnesty for the telephone companies. If that occurs, I believe we'll never know why the eavesdropping started before 9/11 and the true breadth and depth of this operation. And so I'm curious what you think will happen in attempting to reconcile the current House version with the Senate version, where Senator Rockefeller did permit this amnesty or forbearance to the telephone companies.
Well, I'm not a great predictor of the future. I don't know what will happen. I happen to believe that we should not grant amnesty to the phone companies. I think that sets a horrendous precedent by which any president can say to anybody in the private sector, look, I'm asking you to do this. Don't worry about whether it's constitutional or not. I've asked you to do it. And then the private sector is not held accountable for violating constitutional rights. So I think it's a very bad idea. But I think this is just one more example of a president who really knows very little about the Constitution, has very little respect for civil liberties, who has obviously undertaken massive eavesdropping on the American people. And this is an issue that I hope that the Senate will be supporting the House on.
Let's go to Larry in Tacoma, Washington. Larry, welcome to the Tom Hartman program today.
Good morning, Tom, and Peter, and good morning, Senator. Before my question, I'd like just a couple things here. I heard a gentleman on this station who worked for an oil company, and he said that in July of 06, the profit on a barrel of oil was something like $5 to $5.50 a barrel. But in July of 07, the same profit, or the profit on that same barrel was like $23 and something. So I guess what my question would be with, I know they had the CEOs of some of the oil companies in front of Congress, but Senator Stevenson from Alaska said he didn't want to embarrass them by putting them under oath. And is there any way, senators, they can get these same gentlemen in front of Congress again, and this time maybe embarrass them a little bit?
Larry, I agree with you. And Congress certainly has the right to do that. It has the right to put them under oath. It has the right to take strong action against the oil companies. The American people and our economy are reeling with the very, very high price of oil. At the same time as ExxonMobil made $40 billion in profit last year, more money than in any corporation in American history, in world history, in fact. And what you're looking at here is a question of whether or not the Congress has the desire to stand up against enormously powerful forces. My guess is they really do not. And certainly you have a president who is in bed with the oil companies who would veto any serious legislation if we summoned up the confidence to do the right thing. But I think there is no question that the time is long overdue for a windfall profits tax on the oil industry and to take a hard look at how they are doing business, which has been so onerous for so many people in our country.
Thanks for the call, Larry. And, Senator, here's an email that came in also from the Seattle area from Chuck, and it's a bread-and-butter issue. He's a retired engineer. He does volunteer work. And he says, I can't deduct the full amount of my mileage. A business deduction is 50.5 cents per mile, but the deduction for volunteering, he says, is only about 15 cents a mile. Anything you might suggest to achieve parity here?
Yeah, that's a good point. What I can tell Chuck is we have made some progress on a similar type issue just within the last few months dealing with veterans. Veterans, if you can believe it, were getting 11 cents a mile to get to health clinics and hospitals. We raised that to 28 cents, still not enough. But I think Chuck makes a good point. If we're going to encourage volunteerism, we have to help them paying their mileage, what it costs them to get to their job.
Well, and it's creeping up to $4 a gallon here on the West Coast. Dominic now in southern Illinois, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Welcome, Dominic. You're here at Brunch with Bernie.
Thanks for taking my call. Thanks, Senator, for taking my question. My question is, with the stimulus plan that Bush issued and then all the Democrats went along with, my challenge is that we're going to owe the money back next year, plus we got to count it as income next year, and it deflates the currency simultaneously. So I think it's a forced loan upon people. A lot of people don't realize they owe that money back next year, so they're all happy about it. But come next year, it's time to pay back.
Okay, Dominic, it is not going to be taxable. Okay, so that's number one. It will not be taxable. But your point about adding to the national debt is correct. It does. The issue here that we have to deal with, as this country moves toward a recession or is in a recession, what tools do we have to try to stimulate the economy? I don't know that what we did was the best. I think we could have done better. Some of us tried to do better. But it was a step forward in putting money into the pockets of people who needed it so they would spend it so that we create some more jobs.
All right, Dominic, thank you for the call. More with Senator Sanders here on Brunch with Bernie. I'm Peter B. Collins, sitting in for Tom Hartman today.
Tom Hartman, helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege.
We continue on Brunch with Bernie here on the Tom Hartman Program. Peter B. Collins sitting in for Tom today. And just a personal note on the etiquette of brunch. I am personally opposed to the mimosa. I love champagne, and I really love fresh orange juice, and I just think you should keep them in separate vessels. Bernie Sanders with us here. And, Senator, here's a question. from a listener named Mike. I was wondering what Senator Sanders thinks about the Sirius-XM satellite merger. It's been sitting in limbo for over a year, and he wants to know if special interests are keeping it off the agenda. Well, there certainly is a lot of pushback from terrestrial broadcasters, and from my point of view, these licenses for Sirius and XM were granted back in the early 90s after squeezing out plans for other competitors. And so, for me, I think the two companies should remain as competitors, and I don't think creating a monopoly satellite radio company is in the interests of consumers. Your position, sir?
Pete, I honestly don't know enough about it to give you an informed opinion.
Okay. Well, they got one, then. Here's Frank in here's Frank in Los Angeles. Frank, welcome to Brunch with Bernie.
Three questions. The first one is, what's the investigation, what's happening with the investigation of, or if any at all, of the $12 billion that's missing out of the Iraq, out of Iraq, and who's accounting for all the oil that's taking out of the ground over there? And the third one is why do we need a mercenary army like Blackwater?
Well, all right, let's start off with Blackwater. I agree, we don't. Some of us are taking a very hard look at this private contracting that Bush has initiated, not only in the military, not only in Iraq, but all over federal employment areas. He wants to cut back on federal employees. He wants to give those contracts over to his friends in the private sector. I think it's a bad idea. In terms of Iraq, what it means, you're going to have guys fighting alongside other people, where in some cases the Blackwater soldiers are be making five times or more than American soldiers. I think that's a bad idea. Second of all, at a time when we spend $12 billion a month on the war in Iraq, everybody knows there's massive amounts of waste, there's massive amounts of fraud, we in Congress, some people in Congress are taking a good look at that. How much progress we'll have so long as Bush remains in the White House remains to be seen. But the waste and the fraud on top of this war, which never ends, is something which is absolutely a disaster for this country.
Thank you very much, Frank. Now let's go to Mesa, Arizona. It's Hal. Welcome, Hal. You're on the program.
Thank you very much for taking my call. Appreciate it. Mr. Sanders, you've been a longtime supporter of ranked choice voting, instant runoff voting, right?
Yes.
And, you know, I'm a Green. I'm an officer in the local Green Party here in Arizona. And I'm kind of concerned that in a few months from now, when the Democrats lose a few races here and there, and hopefully not the presidential race, but, you know, that they're going to be turning around looking for, you know, a finger to point at somebody, you know, like they usually do. Oh, it was the Greens. If the Greens would just stay home and not vote and so forth. You know, I don't want to have to listen to that again. I think that's unfair. And I'd like to suggest that if the Democrats put this on the agenda for the first 100 days, they would end up with allies in Congress and other places around the country rather than foes or people that
are... Now, what I can tell you is actually in the city of Burlington where I live, we recently initiated instant runoff in the last mayoral election. The perception was that it worked pretty well. I think it makes a lot of sense because it does away with this problem of, gee, I would like to vote for candidate X, but if I do, the worst candidate, in my view, will get elected. I'll be, quote-unquote, wasting my vote and supporting the guy who I don't want. And that addresses that issue, and I think that makes a whole lot of sense. So I believe in that. I think you're seeing more communities moving in that direction, and I think that makes sense.
All right, to George now in Gunder City, Michigan, listening on Detroit's WDTW. Hello, George.
Hi. Thank you, Senator Sanders, for being one of our best leaders in the Senate. And I'd just like to talk about the Columbia trade deal where basically you have a fascist regime, Uribe, that has right-wing paramilitaries going around assassinating union leaders, agrarian reformers, and Bush keeps pushing this because he's afraid of Chavez's populist movement. You know, a government that actually tries to work for the majority of the people. Isn't it just one fascist regime, Bush, trying to prop up another fascist regime?
Well, I would look at it differently, George, as somebody who will vote against the Columbia trade agreement. I think it's part and parcel of an overall trade policy, which included NAFTA, included CAFTA, permanent normal trade relations with China, and on it goes. And these agreements, by and large, are being pushed by the multinational corporations who want the scenario to exist where American workers are forced to compete against people all over the world in developing countries who are making 30, 40, 50 cents an hour. And the result of that has been the loss of many good-paying jobs in this country as corporations throw Americans out on the street and move abroad, but also a real pressure on wages, which is one of the reasons that median family income in America has declined rather significantly since Bush has been president. So I think we need to revisit. I think we need a moratorium on any new trade agreements. I think we need to revisit the old trade agreements and write them in such a way so that they work well for the American middle class and the working people of this country rather than the CEOs of large corporations.
All right. Thank you very much for your call, George. Let's squeeze in one more. Leslie in New Jersey. Just have 1 minute. Go right ahead, Leslie.
Hi. Listen, I've written to my senators and my congressmen. I talk to them to their office. I get no response on Part D Medicare. I'm going to be 73. My wife and I don't take prescription drugs. I don't see why we have to subsidize the system or pay a very large penalty when we get very old to get into a system we may never use use just a few times. It's crazy.
But all right, Part Leslie, D, that's an interesting
Leslie,
anomaly.
You know, I certainly voted against Part D. Bush's proposal was written by the pharmaceutical industry for the pharmaceutical industry. I think we need a Medicare prescription drug program run by Medicare, which will provide much better benefits to our seniors than what currently exists.
Senator Sanders, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, and thanks for the work you put in every week here on Brunch with Bernie.
Okay. Well, Peter, thank you very much. Take care.
All right, good to talk with you. The Tom Hartman program continues, and I remain Peter B. Collins. Glad to be sitting in for Tom as he's recuperating today.
Tom Hartman. Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman program. Program. Welcome to the vast radical middle conspiracy. Accept no imitations. Tom Hartman.
Tom Hartman has the day off. He is recuperating, picked up a bug on his trip to Darfur, and you heard the live broadcast just a week ago today. And over the weekend, we hope Tom gets stronger and better, and I know he wants to be back with you on Monday. I'm Peter B. Collins in San Francisco. Glad to be with you today. If you want to drop me an email, it's peter@peterbcollins.com. And you can call into the program. We'll go back to the phones here in a few minutes at 866-303-2270. Toll free, 866-303-2270. Well, with the subprime mortgage crunch and the other economic problems that our country is facing, we turn to the chief economist of the National Association of Realtors. Lawrence Yoon joins us right now. Mr. Yoon, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you recently were named, number 5 among the top 10 economic forecasters in the country by USA Today. Congratulations to you, and that must be tough to live up to in these difficult times.
Thank you very much. It was an honor. It's a very difficult time, but looking at the housing market trend definitely helped me in better forecasting the economic trends.
What are your current forecasts, and what most people want to know is, have we hit bottom yet?
On the economy, we are essentially at a zero growth zone. So psychologically, I think many people feel that we are in a recession. Officially, technical definition, I think we will avoid the recession. But nonetheless, we are in a slow growth zone, meaning that jobs are not being created. On the housing, economy will not recover without housing market recovery. And I don't see the housing market coming back at least through the first half of this year, and possibly in the second half, as there was a relief for the jumbo loans. Many people in the high-cost region will have access to lower interest rate loan, and that may begin to revive home sales activity in the coastal regions.
Mm-hmm. And what indicators are you looking for to predict the bottom and then the beginning of a recovery, particularly in the housing market?
Well, one looks at all the indicators. I mean, one looks at the mortgage rates historically has been a very powerful leading indicator as to the housing market. Currently, we are at the historically low mortgage rates. Fed has been very aggressive in cutting rates. But at the same time, one cannot presume that Fed cuts will directly translate into lower fixed 30-year mortgage rates. But nonetheless, on the jumbo side, the legislation was passed, president signed, that will permit higher loan limit, which means that Fannie and Freddie can participate on loan activity in San Francisco, in Seattle, and hence there will be much lower rates for consumers in these regions, and consumers will be able to save about $4,000 per year as a result of these changes. And so that will begin to stimulate housing demand. Furthermore, there is a sizable pent-up demand in the marketplace. Home sales have been falling for the past 2 years, yet we have created 4 million net new jobs. There's a sizable pent-up demand. It's just a question as to when they will regain the confidence to enter the market.
Now, the Fed is trying to make more credit available, but what about the lending rules? Lenders have tightened their qualifications. And I've heard stories even of people who are, you know, appear to be very, very well qualified to purchase the home that they're looking for, and they cannot find an attractive loan.
The credit crunch, certainly the risky subprime loans has disappeared from the marketplace, and that's a good thing. Those are risky. It was not good for consumers. It was not good for the economy. It is out of the marketplace. That's a good thing. The FHA loans, which are historically catered to lower and moderate income households with some credit blemishes, that loan program really failed when the subprime took off. But I think there will be revival in the FHA loan program, and hence people will be able to enter the housing market with the government-backed FHA loans. And the credit crunch that you are mentioning, it is being felt particularly in the coastal regions because of the jumbo loans. The global capital providers panicked after the subprime mortgage meltdown, and they said we will not provide any mortgages other than those backed by Fannie and Freddie. Fortunately, with the raising of the loan limit, and administratively, I think you will begin to filter into the marketplace from April, there will be some relief to the jumbo borrowers beginning in April, and some momentum should begin to build up from that point.
Mm-hmm. And Lawrence Yoon from the National Association of Realtors with us here on the Tom Hartman program. As you look at the picture, do you see that this burst of the bubble, this correction in the real estate marketplace, is it going to create opportunities, for example, for people who have been locked out of the market because of high prices? Will the entry level essentially drop in many communities and over the next year to 18 months enable families who've been renting to move up to home ownership?
Anytime there is a crisis, it also represents a moment of opportunity for some astute players. And what we are seeing, for example, in Sacramento, where prices have declined close to 20% in a short 12-month time span, we are seeing increased sales activity in Sacramento. So lower prices are bringing in buyers to the marketplace. At the same time, in some market, I think there's a lot of fear factor. People are just fearful that there's a subprime mess, potentially prices will go down further. So even though people have the financial capacity, they're sitting on the fence. But as Warren Buffett said, when everyone is greedy, be scared. When everyone's scared, be brave. So I think, you know, it may be some opportunity for some people, but no one should overstretch themselves into buying a home.
But, Lawrence Yoon, are some markets really just so far underwater that there's no activity? I talked to one realtor recently about the Stockton-Modesto area of California. It had a huge run-up of new construction, and lots of people who commute into the Bay Area or Sacramento had bought homes there. But this person told me that there's essentially no market. There are no buyers, and the sellers have walked away from their homes because they're underwater from their mortgages.
You are exactly pointing in the market, the inland counties of California, the Stockton, Fresno, Riverside. If I had to pinpoint one market that will run into more prolonged period of price transition would be these regions, because it was they had a high prevalence of subprime lending. At the same time, large active new home construction activity. And hence, I do anticipate a further price decline in the inland counties of California. Now, all real estate is local, therefore, there's a large variation. in the middle part of the country, Texas, Colorado, Rocky Mountain states, they're actually continuing to see 10% price appreciations. One goes up to Seattle. Seattle had a very nice run up in home prices. It's still holding on. The Bay Area, with the job recovery in the technology sector, we are seeing strengthening in home prices in San Jose and San Francisco. So there's a large local market variation.
And what about the tough markets like Las Vegas and Phoenix? Their bubbles really popped in a nasty way.
Over the short term, there's an oversupply condition, so the buyers clearly have an edge. They can negotiate for even 10% or 20% additional discount from what is currently listed. So from the buyer's point of view, it's a paradise. However, long-term prospect for both Vegas, Phoenix, and Florida is actually bright. It's just a short-term transition that they need to undergo one and two years, because if one looks at the migration trend, people from the colder weather states are moving to sunnier, warmer weather states, and with the baby boomer at the retirement age, nearing retirement age, I think this flow of people into warmer, sunnier states will continue. So Las Vegas, Phoenix, over the long term, I am optimistic, but there will be a short term over the next 2 years where there's a great buying opportunity for the buyers.
And Lawrence Yoon, is there any website or software available to the average person to follow some of the trends that you look at and see if, you know, they can make their own predictions or at least be aware of what leading economists like you are predicting?
On our website, which is realtors.org, we provide many statistical information as well as daily commentary by me as along with other colleague economists that we have on staff, and that provides many market trends and forecast information.
All right, sir. Well, it's a pleasure to talk with you, and again, congratulations on your honor, one of the top 10 economic forecasters named by USA Today. We've been talking with Lawrence Yoon, chief economist for the National Association of Realtors. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Nice to talk with you. Open phones next. It's Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. I've got a couple of lines available. Toll free at 866-303-2270. Any topic, any viewpoint, bring it on now. Tom Hartman's Home Recuperating plans to be back with you on Monday. In the meantime, you've got Peter B. Collins here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
And the Tom Hartman Program continues coast to coast. I'm Peter B. Collins in San Francisco. Glad to be in for Tom today. He's at home recovering. Hopes to be back with you on Monday. It's an Anything Goes Friday, so let's get right to the phones. Javier in Miami. Thanks for calling the Tom Hartman Program.
Yes, hi, how you doing? I just wanted to mention, I'm not sure if you've heard, I also sent you an email about the...
I got your email, thank you. Uh-huh.
Okay, the Elliot Spitzer issue and why he was targeted by the Bush administration, that he was on their heels about the subprime mortgage scandal.
Well, there certainly are some anomalies in the investigation, and it's highly unusual, you know, that a prostitution case like that would be followed. I have not yet seen any kind of a smoking gun that shows a serious ethical violation or a miscarriage of justice in the investigation. There's some curiosities about exactly, you know, why they chose to follow him, but the story that's been given is plausible. And unfortunately, Javier, his apparent guilt and his resignation, which is pretty much an admission of all that, and the public nature of all this, makes it very hard to pursue an investigation into the investigation itself to find out if it was properly conducted or if it was a political hit job.
Oh, no, I understand, and I'm not by any means. I agree that what he did was, I mean, he's cracking down on these prostitution rings, and then he's partaking in them. I mean, absolutely, it was wrong what he did. But the fact of the matter is that he wrote an article himself in the Washington Post stating that the Bush administration knew about the subprime scandal and that they actually...
Well, in fact, on Valentine's Day, he was in Washington after this highly publicized meeting with a prostitute, in a Mayflower hotel room just a floor up from where I stayed a couple of months ago.
Right.
It was linked to his desire to testify on Valentine's Day about this issue. But it was really bizarre because it's hard to say whether he got his aides to add him to the schedule. You know, he wasn't expected to testify. He wasn't invited. He kind of invited himself. And it's not clear whether he did that so that he could go to Washington and meet Kristen, or whether the Kristen escapade was simply, a little frivolity for him as he was going to do this testimony that he probably felt pretty strongly about. I can't really evaluate his motives because I just don't know enough about it.
Right. I'll just leave it with this idea or these thoughts is that two things. One is, why haven't they mentioned the other eight people involved in the so-called investigation of the prostitution ring, and they just fingered him. That's one. And the other
well,
one.
Well, just be clear there. You know, the numbers, just because he was number nine doesn't mean that there weren't 100 or 1,000 people who were part of this Emperor's Club.
Why haven't they, you know, mentioned anyone else and just him? And then the other thing is, if you just take a look at, just look at the way that this administration has behaved, and anyone that speaks out or is dead, or hot on their trail about any issue, what is it, the thing that they have done and they continue to do is they demonize you, they pinpoint you, and that's how they shut you up. As a matter of fact, just to, real quick, I'm going through that personally in my own job here, where I have an issue with Senator Mel Martinez in particular down here in Florida, and they've tried to shut me up, threatening to with me losing my job. So I'll just leave you with that.
So you have problems with the senator from Bacardi?
No, from.
That's a joke, Javier. Thank you very much for your call.
I'm sorry.
And I wish you the best with whatever your problem is there. Greg joins us now from Plainwell, Michigan. You're on the Tom Hartman program, Greg.
Well, the comments, I didn't realize that Spitzer was into the subprime loans thing. I was in Vermont when the story broke, and after hearing some of the stuff, I strongly suspected that he was targeted because he was the powerful people got after him. The other things I'd like to mention are three other things real quick. Like, just recently I heard something about the North American Union, something that Bush has been working on, which has not been in the media at all. Another thing is the gentleman that was just on talking about people moving to the Sunshine State from the northern states, and the housing market picking up. Well, that will only happen if the houses in the northern states sell. Right now in Michigan, I've got houses here that haven't been sold for years, and they're not going to sell because there's nobody here that's going to buy them because of the job situation. And the last thing I wanted to mention was, obviously, the Democrats don't want to win the election because they don't care about Michigan or Florida voters. We voted, and the DNC is just thumbing its nose at us, and quite frankly, they're pissing off a whole bunch of people, and they're not going to get, unless they see the delegates, it just came down that Michigan can't do a revote. Unless they seat the delegates from Michigan and Florida, they're going to lose the election.
Well, I don't agree with you, Greg. Number one, this is an intra-party squabble. The rules were set before the election started, and I'm sorry for Florida and Michigan, but I'm not in favor of reruns because you cannot recreate the context of January. A lot of those candidates aren't in the game anymore. Things have changed, and I think that we have to seat the delegates and not permit them to vote on the first ballot, and I would release them to vote on the second ballot if I were in charge. So far, nobody seemed fit to put me in charge of anything except, well, sitting in for Tom Hartman today, and I'll do my best to get through the entire program. Thank you for your call from Michigan today. It's an Anything Goes Friday. We'll see what happens next on the telephone at 866-303-2270, the Tom Hartman program.
This is the Tom Hartman program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
We continue on the Tom Hartman program today. Tom is at home recuperating, picked up a bug, and on his travels to Darfur or back And he is recovering over the weekend. We hope he'll be back with you on Monday. It's Peter B. Collins from San Francisco sitting in with you today. And I'm glad to be here for Tom. You can call in at 866-303-2270. That's toll-free 866-303-2270. Well, Barack Obama is campaigning in Oregon today, and Bill Richardson, one of the competitors up until January in the presidential campaign, Richardson of New Mexico, is going to endorse Barack Obama, and he has released a statement in advance, quote, "I believe he is the kind of once-in-a-lifetime leader that can bring our nation together and restore America's moral leadership in the world. As a presidential candidate, I know full well Senator Obama's unique moral ability to inspire the American people to confront our urgent challenges at home and abroad in a spirit of bipartisanship and reconciliation." Well, this is a very interesting move. Consider that just, 6 weeks back, Bill Richardson was watching the Super Bowl with Bill Clinton. And, of course, Bill Richardson owes some of his prowess in diplomacy to the confidence that Bill Clinton invested in him as U.N. ambassador, as a roving ambassador, and prior to that, not that this was a diplomacy position, but as Secretary of Energy. So Richardson's ties to the Clinton family, the Clinton administration, are very strong. And for him to endorse Obama at this point, I think, is very interesting. John Edwards, who is actually sitting on some delegates, is the guy now in the catbird seat. Unfortunately, Richardson pulled out even before Super Tuesday, and to my recollection, has no delegates or just a handful pledged to him. And as a result, it's not clear to me politically what the impact of this will be in terms of the delegate hunt and the competition between Clinton and Obama for the nomination. Let's go to New York now. In Queens, Victor is on the line. Victor, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Peter B.
Good afternoon. My first question is involving the Reverend Wright Obama scenario or situation. I want to ask a question first from you. What has black people done to the people of America or white people of America or anyone in America who makes them so scared of a black man candidacy, a black man run for the White House, or just a black man in power? What has America done that, even with that question being raised, what can black America or black people do to rectify the situation? Because it appears that every time a black man pokes his head out of the ground and wants to aspire to something that has been established by the white population or the white framers or the ones in power, he can get so far and then here something comes. With the Reverend Wright debacle, I'm going to call it debacle because it was something that shouldn't have been. It was something that maybe he shouldn't have associated himself with. But we have to look at these things in two facets. Okay, he brought him to the faith of Christianity from whatever faith Obama was in. That hasn't been disclosed. But he brought him in. And he looked at him as a spiritual father. And there has been things, I come from a black church. I come from, my father's a pastor. My father speaks on different issues that I don't agree with. But I stay there, and I was saying that that's your father, so you have a tie that you can't break. But
well, Victor, let me jump in here because I was watching Hardball last night, and Chris Matthews was tripping all over himself, demanding, you know, whether or not at some point Obama pulled the pastor aside and said, you know, I think you went too far on that. I don't agree that AIDS was a conspiracy to kill black Americans. And
Hold on, Victor.
Here was Matthews, and in the same breath that he challenged Barack Obama to prove that he had taken on Reverend Wright and shown some disagreement, Matthew said, you know, I've told my pastor when I agree with him, but I actually haven't spoken up when I don't agree with him. And this is something that goes on with most religious people. I challenge you to show me an individual who has come up to a rabbi or a preacher or a priest after a service and engaged him in a lengthy argument about the substance of the homily or the sermon delivered. The only place I've ever seen it, Victor, I'm not Jewish, but I went to a bar mitzvah where the rabbi interjected comments about his opposition to the death penalty, and it enraged some members of the congregation who actually spoke up because it was a dialogue that was encouraged by the rabbi himself. But that's one of the few cases where I've ever seen churchgoers offer disagreement to the pulpit. Usually it is a one-way conversation.
Can I answer
that? Go ahead, Victor. Yeah.
Okay, because in the Jewish faith, they're basically going by the Old Testament, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. They still strongly believe in that to a certain extent in some Jewish sectors of the faith. So they believe that if you kill somebody, you should be killed. And that goes on in Israel every day, as you can see.
Well, Victor, Victor, you're misunderstanding what I said. The rabbi spoke out against capital punishment.
Oh, okay. Okay, that's right. So they denounce it because they believe in the faith of Abraham, which was an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. But let me go back to what you said about confronting your pastor.
Uh-huh.
We're looking at someone who is the president of the United States of your church. So you go in the church and you feel that the church sermon has different facets. You go in it for the spiritual message, and then sometimes there's a social message. There's sometimes where he can speak on things that affect your life, like in the Bible. You have to find yourself in the Bible. So he can speak on things that are in the Bible that reflect on you. So these people are basically, you know, torn between two different powers. You have the spiritual
power, but it's broader. Victor, it's broader than that, because
I was
raised in the Catholic Church,
right.
And I don't support the Catholic Church's teachings on abortion, on contraception, and on homosexuality.
Right.
But when I was going to church, I would listen to the sermon, and I would leave, and I would think about what was said, but it didn't mean that I agreed with what was said.
Well, you don't have to agree with everything you hear. And this is an intelligent man. And you get the church, that church, and all the churches that I know of have different agendas in the church. They said I hear on the CNN and the racist Fox Network how, oh, he had his children sitting in church listening to this rhetoric. That's not true, because those churches are sectioned off. The young people of those churches have different sermons going on while the main service is going on. The young people are not going to understand what this man is talking about. So they have different places where these young people sit down and talk. They have Sunday school in the morning from 10 o'clock to 12 o'clock where the young people have a chance to be heard and to be taught. And then they have the main messages that go on from 12 o'clock to 4 o'clock where the older adults come in and listen to the main pastor. They have associate pastors that work at these churches that have messages.
Okay, Victor, I have your point, and I got a switchboard full of callers, so I got to cut it here and move on. But I thank you for joining us today, and I appreciate your comments and contribution. Chris, I have lost my connection on the computer, so tell me which the next caller is, please. All right, Doug joins us now. Doug, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Yeah, how you doing? Great show today. You had the realtor who's on earlier, and I think that his words about how glad he is that these subprime mortgages are coming to an end. I have family members that are realtors, and in my opinion, realtors are like used car salesmen. Those people pump those subprime loans out to anybody that was willing to sign a check. All they cared about was getting their commission on the real estate deal. They didn't care. And now they're trying to blame it on the companies that offered these things and not on themselves. They are the ones with the dirty hands in this, because they didn't care. All they cared about was their 4% or whatever it is they get on a real estate deal. And that's why the mess is so bad here in Michigan. I mean, I live in the hometown of the Henry Ford Museum and the Henry Ford Company, and you would not believe, this is a wealthy area, you wouldn't believe how many empty houses there are within sight of the headquarters of the Ford Motor Company. Thousands.
Well, I have been to Dearborn, and I've been to many other areas of Detroit where it appears that only half of the homes are occupied in a given block.
Right.
And that others are burned out, boarded up, or abandoned, or homes for squatters. And so I do know that kind of deterioration that you're talking about. But it's more complex than blaming realtors. Realtors, work on behalf of individuals as an agent. And it's a complex relationship. But I would look much more at the lenders, because the lenders operated in a predatory manner. Those are commission-based people who got higher commissions for placing these subprime mortgages and the ones with the variable rates. And that's where I would, you know, I'm not trying to exonerate anybody who's part of the process, but I would say that it's the financial institutions that poured this money out there. There were zero down loans. There were 110% loans. There were these, loans where you only pay the interest at the end of the loan. And all of those are highly risky. And some people certainly took them with an open mind and understood everything that they were signing. But there were a lot of others who were jammed into subprime loans because they benefited the lenders and the agents working for the lenders, the mortgage brokers.
Sure. But don't the realtors have some personal responsibility for acting in an ethical and moral manner? I mean, they should have had the foresight to say, this doesn't smell right, and I don't think I want to be a part of something that is borderline ethical, you know.
Well, I happen to know realtors, and one of them is the love of my life. And the ones I know are ethical and do not try to steer people into homes they can't afford. But sometimes the clients are not honest about their true financial position and what they can afford. So it's a push-pull situation. Doug, thanks for your call from Dearborn. We're going to take a break and return here on the Tom Hartman program. More of your calls coming up toll-free at 866-303-2270. It's an Anything Goes Friday. We'll talk to you next.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege.
That is the voice of Tom Hartman, who would love to be with you today, but he's recuperating from something he picked up on his trip to Darfur. And, Tom, we wish you all the best. Hope you can be back on Monday. I'm Peter B. Collins, sitting in for Tom today. Glad to be here, taking your calls toll-free here on Anything Goes Friday. It's 866-303-2270. John in San Jose, listening on Green 960. Welcome to the program.
Hello. I really think, though, concerning Obama, people have been sort of shoved into exactly the wrong position in defending him, because I think exactly what has been said by his pastor has to be said by many more within the political spectrum. It's exactly those kinds of statements that I find refreshing, and I find the kind of depressing centrist, so-called centrist twaddle, the vapid bromides, and the fast populist posturing of both Hillary and Obama to be the real problem in this whole campaign.
Well, John, let me say that while the soundbite is inconvenient, the point that Reverend Wright was making about the immorality of the war in Iraq and our killing of innocent women and children is a very strong one, and it is unfortunately being lost in the soundbite that has been lifted. And, John, I want to just pull in an email here that Liz sent in that I want to disagree with. She says, I think that Obama wanted the pastor scandal because he'd rather have this scandal than have people think he's Muslim. This has served the purpose of letting all of America know that he is Christian. Well, Liz, with all due respect, this has come out of Fox News. The whole scandal over these videotapes, which have been around for a long time, has been fueled by Sean Hannity, and he took credit for it on television the other night. And what he did after that was also take credit for bringing on the slimy Swiftboat veterans who attacked John Kerry's wartime service back in 2004. And just think of that linkage in Sean Hannity's mind, all right? And what will they find next? Next hour, we're going to tell you about a prayer group that Hillary Clinton belongs to or has belonged to. And the New York Times published a photo today of Bill Clinton standing right next to, in fact, he's shaking hands with Jeremiah Wright at a prayer breakfast in the White House in 1998 that was timed to coincide with the release of Ken Starr's report on the Monica Lewinsky scandal. So the Clintons have kept a low profile on the right controversy because this can bite them as well.
Yes.
But you need to see it as something that has been fueled openly by those fine folks at the Fox News Channel.
Yes, I understand that, but I think that rather than biting on this, we should be applauding many of the things that Pastor Wright has said, and rather than what Obama said in response to it to the Huffington Post. It was an absolute, I think, cowardly denunciation. He said, "I categorically denounce any statement that disparages our great country or serves to divide us from our allies." Now, that's the kind of thing you'd hear from a John McCain, a Bush, or a Cheney. And I think that kind of reaction shows that this so-called hope of change and audacity and the rest of it is totally delusional on the part of Obama. And the danger.
Well, I don't agree. I don't agree with
you
there.
The only point I want to make here is that if people assume that this is the alternative, they're going to make endless excuses for the kinds of dithering and prolonging and of the war and the occupation of the Middle East and an attack possibly against Iraq, Iran, and even against countries like Pakistan. We got to realize that the advisor to Obama is this very sinister Rasputin, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who
wait, John, he had lunch with Brzezinski once 2 years ago. He's had a phone call with him since. Brzezinski is not an official advisor to the Obama campaign, and you got to get that straight. Thank you for your call. We go to Joanne in Pittsburgh, listening on WPTT. Welcome, Joanne.
Hi. I just wanted to tell you that you asked about somebody who would talk back to their priest or preacher or whoever.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, I did. I'm Catholic. I've been born and raised a Catholic. And if I don't like what's being said on the pulpit or the message sent out by the cardinal or the pope, I mm-hmm. speak up, and I write
Good
letters, and I also go to the church. Last year, 4 years ago, when John Kerry was running for president, we had the cardinal.
Yes, we did.
And he's now the pope, who said John Kerry had no right to receive communion because he believed in pro-choice.
Mm-hmm.
Pro-choice.
That's right.
Okay. At that time, I stopped going to communion, and I told the priest I didn't like the Catholic religion getting involved with the politics of the
mm-hmm.
nation.
Right.
And they should butt out. And at that time, I stopped giving money to the church because I feel that's the only way you can hurt them is in their pocketbook. And since then, I have stopped going to church.
All right, now,
I
Joanne,
still believe
to your
in
point.
God.
I'm proud of you for your independence and your expression. Do you project that onto Barack Obama? Do you say that at some point he should have gone to Pastor Wright and said, you know, I don't agree with this or I don't agree with that?
No. I think it's very difficult. I think now I have also walked out of church when they start passing out the pro-life things. But I think if he was present, I think he should have excused himself and walked out.
Mm-hmm.
When I hate America. But, I mean, I think...
Wait. He didn't say I hate
well,
America.
Well, that type of thing, okay?
Okay, but we've got to be... Joanne, you're on the right side of this issue, but you got to be careful and not, repeat these Republican talking points and the gibberish that comes out of Fox News. He said, God damn America, for the immorality of the war in Iraq. And that is a point that is consistent with the gospel, in my humble opinion. Joanne, thank you very much for your call. And we do acknowledge that this is Good Friday, a very important and a sober day on the Christian calendar. It leads to the celebration of Easter on Sunday, and Jews around the world are observing Purim at this time. I'm Peter B. Collins. We've got another hour of the Tom Hartman Program. I hope you'll stay with us here on Air America Radio.
Exposing the con in conservative con. This is the Tom Hartman Program. The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Tom Hartman's one of the hardest working people in progressive talk radio, and I know he'd love to be here today, but he's at home recuperating, picked up some kind of bug on his journey to Darfur, and we wish him all the best for a speedy recovery. He hopes to be back with you on Monday. I'm Peter B. Collins, and I'm here in San Francisco. I want to acknowledge the transcontinental effort underway here. Marcus and Chris are at the controls in New York at Master Control at Air America, and Sean at Hartman HQ in Portland. Thank you all for enabling me to do the program here today. Well, it's stunning. I never expected that the presidential campaigns would be engaged in such a deep reaction and debate, not about important issues of religion and the role of religion in our political life, and I believe there should be a strong separation between church and state, but over who listens to what preacher and which preacher has endorsed whom. And a few weeks back, Barack Obama had to repudiate any inferred endorsement of his candidacy by Minister Louis Farrakhan. And now he is responding ably, if you take the Philadelphia speech earlier this week as an indicator, to these attacks based on his association with Pastor Jeremiah Wright in Chicago. And it hasn't stopped. Today, a picture in the New York Times of Bill Clinton with Jeremiah Wright. And Bill Clinton was shaking his hand and using Wright and other pastors to create a photo op to counter the release of the Star report about the Monica Lewinsky scandal. That was back in 1998. And Patrick Healy of the Times, in a political memo, speculates that that's why the Clinton campaign has not piled on the issues of Jeremiah Wright. But it doesn't stop there. John McCain, after repudiating Bob Jones and George W. Bush's embrace of Bob Jones back in 2000, has come full circle. And Pastor Hagee has today gone public and said that John McCain asked for his endorsement. And earlier this week, when I was in Washington, I spoke with David Korn. He's now the bureau chief for Mother Jones Magazine in Washington. And he's published a piece you can find at motherjones.com about another McCain pastor pal named Rod Parsley of Ohio. And now there is more about Senator Clinton's religious practices and who she is involved with. Jeff Charlotte joins us right now. He is a contributing editor to Harper's and Rolling Stone magazines, and he also writes on religion at a website called therevealer.org. Jeff Charlotte, welcome to the Tom Hartman program today.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Yes, we've spoken before, and it's a pleasure to talk with you again. I learned about your new book that is coming out called The Family from a blog post by Barbara Ehrenreich. And I wanted you to first tell us what this family is. It's not a Sister Sledge song, right?
No, if only. It's a network of very conservative, at the core, very conservative evangelical activists who seek to reach out and influence only the powerful. They believe in a Christ of power for the powerful. So they'll work with anybody. That distinguishes them from conventional fundamentalists. But on the other hand, I mean, they'll work with anyone if you're a senator or a congressperson or something like that. They call themselves The Family. They describe themselves as an invisible organization. And they say they do this because they want to make safe space for powerful people to talk about their religious feelings and how that guides them in politics. The only public event they do every year is the National Prayer Breakfast, which they refer to as a recruiting device, which you can draw people into sort of a different level of secessions of small groups that they call cells. They've been calling them cells for 50 years. And there you get exposed to a very authoritarian model of religion.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell us a little bit about Hillary Clinton and how she got involved with this prayer group back in 1993.
Well, I wrote about The Family in Harper's in 2003, and for that I spent about a month living with members of The Family before I even knew how political they were, and I was shocked.
Would you call that embedded?
I was embedded, although I wasn't undercover. I had no idea what they were, so I just strolled right up and said, "Hi, guys, what you doing?" And what they were doing was practicing this religion modeled on the leadership model of, this would be repeated over and over, Hitler, Lenin, and Mao. And there's some audio now, actually, of Doug Coe, the leader of the family, talking about Hitler, Lenin, and Mao that's just gone up online. But I was surprised when I heard one of these people say that Hillary Clinton was a friend of the family. And sure enough, when her biography came out, she writes in her biography that in 1993, when she moved to Washington, she joined a prayer cell at the family at their headquarters, which is a mansion in Arlington, with the wives of several Republican power brokers, James Baker's wife, who Susan Baker is also on the board of James Dobson's Focus on the Family, and Joanne Kemp, the wife of Jack Kemp, who has been instrumental in bringing the religious right to Washington, and several others. And, you know, it was all out there in the open. She referred to Doug Coe, this man who talks about Hitler, Lenin, and Mao, as a loving spiritual mentor. And so I thought that was worth investigating, and Catherine Joyce and I did so with support from the Nation Institute and Mother Jones.
Mm-hmm. And I don't want to get involved with guilt by association because I
absolutely
reject
not
that as it's applied to others, but I think it's important to know who the members of the family are that many of our listeners would be able to identify. Sam Brownback, he ran for president, senator from Kansas. Ed Meese, he was Ronald Reagan's attorney general and a crusader against porn. John Ashcroft, well-known first attorney general of George W. Bush. Senator James Inhofe, a hardcore conservative. Rick Santorum, a former senator from Pennsylvania, also known for his extreme religious conservatism. And so it is a little bit stunning to imagine that Hillary Clinton sought to pray with these people. And I don't second guess anybody on how they pray, who they choose to listen to or share their own religious views with. But given the context now, this is a little disconcerting.
It is disconcerting, and I'm glad you said, though, that we should be careful about guilt by association. And I should say, this is not some kind of anti-Hillary attack. I actually voted for Hillary. But I think she's asked us to take her religion seriously. She said that her faith influences how she makes political decisions. And so we do so, and we look at, well, where does she look for spiritual authority? And she looks to this very authoritarian version. Now, I should say, the guys you mentioned, a lot of those people are members of the family, and Hillary is a friend of the family. And these are, within the family, semi-formal designations. I once referred to Hillary as a member, and they said, no, she's a friend. she was in the outer circle. She was surely never exposed to any of the talk about Hitler, Lenin, and Mao. I don't think we should make too much of this. I don't think this is not a scandal, but I do think we should take it seriously, and we should do what the press should always be doing, is if someone comes out there and says, I'm influenced, I'm running for president, and I'm influenced by X, Y, and Z, we should ask, well, what do you take from X, Y, and Z? I agree with you that this guilt by association is terrible, and I don't want this to be seen as suggesting that Hillary is some kind of fascist. But she did go for spiritual counseling to a man who has some pretty frightening thoughts.
Well, part of my interest, Jeff, in getting this out is that I would like to see the whole set of issues put to rest, that I believe Hillary has the right to associate with these individuals. It's politically embarrassing, perhaps. And in the same manner, I don't think that Barack Obama has to spend the rest of time between now and November distancing himself and renouncing the remarks of Jeremiah Wright. And
Absolutely not. Well, the thing is, he answered the question, and he answered it beautifully. People were demanding, what do you take from this church? That's a legitimate question. If you go out there and you say, hey, I'm a politician and I'm guided by faith, then it becomes a legitimate question. This is not interfering in their personal life. So people said, Obama, how are you guided by this church? And he gave a beautiful answer. And it was he taught us a lot, and it was a great answer. That I actually switched to Obama after that speech. Hillary, on the other hand, also has been going out and saying, take my faith seriously, take my faith seriously. When we wrote about her in Mother Jones, we were one of the first people to do so, Catherine Joyce and I, and look at her faith throughout her life. We didn't just focus on this and say, look, this is the source of a lot of your political and philosophical thinking. How does it influence your thinking? That's an issue I don't think you should put to rest. I don't think ideas have consequences. In that sense, I'm a conservative. I believe that old line. Well, what are the ideas and what are the consequences? And you know, Hillary could come forth and say, look, what I liked about this group was solely the bipartisanship. I don't like this, you know, this idea that Hitler is a leadership model. That's not my speed, you know. That would be fine. But I do think we need to, when a politician says, look, I want you to judge me by my faith, well, okay, let's see what they got.
Well, and I want religion to remain primarily a private matter that may influence people's public positions, their public policy, and their political calculations. But I don't necessarily, I mean, George W. Bush has promoted himself as a man of religion, and nobody asks any questions about when he goes to church, who his pastor is, and what kind of sermons or fire and brimstone he has heard and inculcated into his bad policies.
But
Jeff Charlotte,
should have.
I certainly do.
Yeah, so
but
I agree with you that religion can be private, but when the person makes it public, then we got to take it seriously.
Jeff Charlotte, thanks for joining us today. Your new book's coming out in May. It's called The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power.
Thanks,
you, Jeff. And again, his website where he is published too is therevealer.org. That's therevealer.org. 17 minutes after the hour, I'm Peter B. Collins here on the Tom Hartman Program. We're going to take your calls for the rest of the hour, so join me toll free, 866-303-2270.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Tom has the day off. I'm Peter B. Collins. Good to be with you. You can drop me an email because all the phone lines are jammed right now. Peter@peterbcollins.com. Some great comments coming in from some of our listeners today. Marty wanted to note that the last woman who called last hour said she had walked out of a Catholic church when she didn't agree with the sermon. And she indicated that Obama could have and should have gotten up and walked out of a sermon when Reverend Wright made those comments. Now, Obama has said he wasn't in attendance, particularly on the occasion when the God Damn America statements were made. And Marty notes one cannot walk away from the sermon when one is not there. Simple and powerful. Let's go to Suzanne in West Nyack. Welcome, Suzanne. You're on the Tom Hartman Program, and this is Peter B.
Hi. I'm calling because I think that, you know, you can't be guilt by association is just wrong, but I am concerned that Reverend Wright did attack Hillary Clinton in that speech that he gave Christmas of 07. And,
now, this is one that hasn't reached me, Suzanne. Tell me.
I don't know of any direct comments he's made. He said that Hillary, you know, didn't know what it was like to be a black man, and Hillary didn't know what it was like, and she, you know, he named different injustices that have been done to African Americans, and I felt that how sad that this woman was attacked when the reason I believe she became interested in politics was through a reverend that brought her to see Martin Luther King. And I think that the press has just neglected that to comment on that. Now I find that much more an important statement than the other things he said, because we all go to churches where things we don't agree with are said and all, and you could leave or just ignore it or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel that that was very important, and I do feel, honestly, I think I'm the only one left of a group of progressives in New York, where in my area in New York City, that are listening to Air America, because they do feel that it has been kind of biased in one way for Barack Obama. And I've been campaigning since Bobby Kennedy days.
Mm-hmm.
My husband's a Vietnam vet.
Suzanne,
and,
I'll just tell you that I... Hold on, Suzanne. I just fill in on Air America, so I won't presume to speak for others.
Oh, sure.
But I want to be very clear that I have a program of my own on the West Coast, and I announce to my listeners, by the way, I don't endorse candidates or tell people how to vote, but that I am supporting Barack Obama, and I made that decision toward the end of last year.
Uh-huh.
So I want my own biases or opinions just to be out there for you to evaluate.
I don't mind an endorsement at all. I think that's fine. But what I do mm-hmm. mind is when why many of us have stopped listening is that other hosts have gone out of their way to demonize the other Democrat. And I only think it's going to help John McCain become president. And I do think that that Christmas 07 speech, which was only shown once or twice, again, no one has come out and apologized
to Hillary
Clinton. All right, well,
Clinton.
Suzanne, since I haven't seen that one, I'll ask my good pal Sean Hannity to send me the clip, okay? Thank you for your call today. Let's go to Kaiser. I don't have a location for Kaiser, but Kaiser, you're on the air here on the Tom Hartman program.
Hello, Peter B.
Hi.
Hello, yes. Nice of you to fill in. I enjoy listening to you as well. Hooray. Before I get to my main point, I have three things I want to hit very quickly, but I must say right away, hooray to that lady who just spoke to you.
Mm-hmm.
That is the first person up and down the dial, newspaper anywhere, that has said that Reverend Jeremiah, someone, owes Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton an apology. No one should be jumping that lady. She hasn't bothered anyone. She has nothing to do with this. Here's what he said, and I want to get back to my statement in a moment. Hillary ain't never been called a... Boom.
Well,
Hillary
ain't never been called a... Kaiser, don't impersonate. You can quote.
Right.
But...
Okay, I'm sorry. But that's the way you sounded. You see, what I'm getting to, Peter B., is this. You know this, and all of your listeners should know this. There's some things we cannot say. The penalty is too high for saying them. There's some things we cannot... We shouldn't say, even though we can say them. Some things depend upon what we say. Some things how we say. Some things to whom we say and what we say about them. Now, what Pastor Jeremiah said, some of the things he said were quite true, but it was that tone of voice. And the main thing, I want to get to the thing about, Congressman, she skips him right now, the lady who made the comment about Senator Obama. Then I'll get back to Senator Obama. What she was saying was, anyone with this little service in the Senate or the House as Senator Barack Obama would not be considered a challenge to Hillary Clinton, no matter what party he was. Mainly, they say Senator John Edwards, who speaks very eloquently, very youthful. He was
okay, you're referring to Ferraro there. Kaiser, I'm sorry the clock is run and I can't stop this break coming. I appreciate your comments here today. We'll take more calls on Anything Goes Friday right after the break on the Tom Hartman Program. Sitting in, I'm Peter B. Collins.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Tom is home today, hoping to feel better and be back with you on Monday. I'm Peter B. Collins. It's 34 minutes after the hour. And it's Anything Goes Friday. Your calls are welcome here, toll-free at 866-303-2270. Email from Margaret in San Diego. Do you think McCain is getting a free pass in this campaign as we Democrats still figure out who we're putting on the ballot? Well, it's a little disconcerting because the poll numbers in the last week show that Obama did suffer a decline and that Hillary Clinton has pulled ahead of him in terms of Democratic primary preferences by about 6 points. And it remains to be seen what the impact of the Philadelphia speech earlier this week will be. But what's most concerning to me is that in the matchups between McCain and Obama and McCain and Clinton, McCain has pulled ahead of both Democratic candidates. Now, this is short term. Some of it is that the dissension in the ranks of the Republicans is quelling just a bit. Rush Limbaugh was busy getting voters to play games in the Ohio and Texas primaries and kind of moved on from his attacks on John McCain. Also, there's just no question that Republicans are now starting to accept that, even if McCain was not their first, second, or third choice, and that the Democratic debate is still alive and well. And certainly, those of us who support Obama have a dream that the Clintons would gracefully step aside. But I have to tell you that I understand. I understand Hillary's supporters and the passion that they have for her, including my mom. She voted for Hillary in Ohio. And I understand that it is very close. Now, statistically, the nomination isn't out of Hillary's grasp, but it is a longer and longer reach for her. And at some point, many people, including some Clinton supporters, have told me they hope that she would step aside and acknowledge that Barack Obama has the lead. But we have to be honest that Obama has not clinched this. He does not have enough delegates, and we really need to see this process play out. And that's why there's so much jockeying, mostly coming from the Clinton campaign, to seat the delegates from Florida and Michigan. And I understand the chagrin and the disappointment. We had a caller from Michigan earlier who's was saying that if the Michigan delegation is not seated either due to a re-election or some other compromise, the Michigan voters will turn against the Democrats in the fall? I really don't think so. Some, yes. I think there's some people who get very angry and bitter, and they will withhold their vote, or they'll vote for Nader, or, you know, maybe do a write-in candidate for their favorite TV news anchor. But I don't think it is statistically significant. And as we get closer to November, when it's down to a choice between one Democrat and John McCain, I don't think people are going to hold a grudge about the primary process and the way the DNC handled Florida and Michigan. I do understand that those voters feel left out or marginalized, but we have to play by the rules, in my opinion. And as we get started with the March Madness, the NCAA Hoops Champs, would you change the rules of that in midstream? And what about something as sacred as American Idol? Would you sit still if they changed the process midway through the season? Well, think about that. Let's go to Chris in New York. Welcome, Chris. You're on the Tom Hartman program. This is Peter B.
Oh, hi. I didn't expect to go on so early, so soon. You have a very prudent voice, and that's why I'm calling. I usually listen to Tom Hartman, and he's about the only one that I listen to on Air America anymore. I loved Air America when it came on, when Mike Malloy was on. And that was a sure thrill. But anyway, the reason I'm calling is because I'd like to very quickly say, while I was waiting, you were speaking, I have to tell you, I have very deep resentment that two states are going to be excluded from the voting process. Now, I understand the rules and all that other mumbo-jumbo, but the fact that we are excluding two states and accepting it in the way that we are really disturbs me, regardless of whom you're for. You know, I just find that really undemocratic. And whoever is the, you know, the ultimate nominee, I'm just going to feel that it wasn't fair because we are excluding a huge portion of the population. And having said that, I just want to reiterate and re-echo what I was so glad that woman who just called before, she really touched me. You know, I am not a Clinton, I'm not a Hillary fan per se, okay? I'm not a fan of hers. I mean, I disagree with a lot of what she did. But I have to tell you, I have been totally turned off, and not as a woman, just as a listener and as a thinker, totally turned off at the vitriol that I see that I don't feel that, not because I feel I have to defend her. I don't think she needs defending. She can defend herself very well, you know. But I just feel that it's a total distraction. I mean, going back to that speech, that woman is the only person I heard making that statement. I've made that statement repeatedly since this whole flap over the speech by Reverend Wright came on. I was very surprised with all of these talking heads on television who are totally overpaid. I was very surprised that no one referred to that sentence in his speech, and I'll tell you why. Because, you know, he said, you know, the previous caller said, you know, Hillary doesn't know what it's like. She's a rich person. She's a white person. I was trying to see the connection within the context of all of the political statements that he made that I happen to have agreed with. I agree with, by the way, most of the statements. The delivery is very, you know, fire and brimstone. Yeah. But I was very surprised at that his attack on her as a person, and I found it almost like it was unnecessary. It was like adding an ingredient, you know, to something that just did not belong there. I couldn't understand.
The other thing that I'll add here is that if, in fact, Reverend Wright was engaged in a kind of politicking from the pulpit, I consider that out of bounds. And I'm not going to call the IRS and suggest that they take away the tax-exempt status of the Trinity Church. But it is something that I object to when it comes from the religious right, and it's something I object to when it comes from a religious man named Wright.
Well, I agree. Thank you for saying that. That's all I needed to hear. That's what I wanted to confront, because that's exactly what he was doing. Now, I don't begrudge Obama for this. You know, everyone's church and their religion is totally their own, and I feel that we make way too much of a deal of people's personal spiritual life. I mean, I just...
Well, but also, it is being used for political reasons, and I'm not accusing either Obama or Clinton of doing that.
Right.
But religion has become too much a part of our political debate. We saw in 2004 the Republicans rode these anti-same-sex marriage referenda to getting out the vote of religious conservatives, including Catholics, and I object to that. And so I really want to see all candidates separate political life from religious life, and it doesn't bother me if they want to cite religion as a source of inspiration, as a source of their own personal values, but I draw the line when it enters the public sector and the public debate, and we've crossed that line big time right here. Thank you, Chris. Now to Violet on the other coast in Seattle, listening to KPTK. Hello, Violet.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for calling, and you've been waiting. Go right ahead.
Yeah, that's okay. I wanted to respond to the idea that Clinton is somehow getting more negative press than Obama, and as a woman, I feel that I think it's very simple. I think that when you run negative campaigns, you get negative press, and that it's deserved. I think when you run a positive campaign, like Barack Obama has, you deserve to get positive press. He's only been very transparent. He's written two books very open about who he is and what he thinks. And I think he deserves to get positive press if he does. I think he's gotten just as much negative press as Hillary. But I also believe that Senator Clinton has run a rather negative campaign and that we're getting away from that fact. You know what I mean?
Well, I'm glad you raised this point because there are a couple of things I want to mention. One is, at the Take Back America conference in Washington the other day, one of the people I interviewed was a man named Richard Goodstein, and he is Hillary's top delegate counter. And he was taking the position that these attacks from the Clinton campaign on Obama are good for Obama, and that it's good to get them out there in the public domain in case he is the nominee. It'll toughen him up and, you know, give him those extra scabs that will protect him. Well, I take a different view, and I said this directly to Richard, because he was part of the Gore campaign in the primary back in 1987-88. And I like to remind people that the Willie Horton idea came out of an attack by Al Gore against Michael Dukakis. And then it was picked up in the fall by Lee Atwater and the others on the Bush campaign, and it became a very effective hit piece that injected race into that campaign. Now, would the Republicans have discovered it on their own? Perhaps. But it was delivered to them with a bow by the Gore campaign, and my concern is that the 3 a.m. phone call, that her negative comparison, that she and McCain are ready to be commander-in-chief, and you got to ask Senator Obama, that those things will come back to haunt her even if she's the nominee, and they will most certainly be used against Obama if he is the nominee.
And even hesitating, as she did, about what his religion is, I mean, I agree with you that religion doesn't need to be a part of this campaign, in the sense that I'm very much for separation of church and state.
The one other thing, Violet, that I want to mention is that when you zoom out and look at the mechanics of a political campaign, one of the things you look at is the comparative positives and negatives of each candidate. Hillary Clinton and now Bill Clinton have very high negatives. The only way that they can prevail in this campaign is to drive up the negatives of Barack Obama. And I don't believe that the Clinton campaign orchestrated the right stuff. I think this came out of Fox News and good old Sean Hannity. But the other attacks that we talked about are conscious, have come from the Clinton campaign, and this is an effort to drive up the negatives of Barack Obama, and that could cost Democrats in the fall, particularly based on the current matchup polls with McCain. Thanks for your call, Violet. More in a moment on the Tom Hartman Program. This is Peter B. Collins.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege.
Tom Hartman is exercising his health care rights and working to get better. Should be back with you on Monday. I'm Peter B. Collins, sitting in for Tom today. And just got word via alternate. I want to thank a listener for forwarding the link to me. Rush Limbaugh, as you know, encouraged Republican voters in Ohio to cross over and vote for Hillary Clinton. And they did so in large numbers. In one county, fully one-third of Republican voters took Democratic ballots. And it turns out that under certain circumstances, what Limbaugh has encouraged Republican voters to do in Ohio was a fifth-degree felony. punishable by a $2,500 fine and 6 to 12 months in jail, because in order to change your party affiliation in Ohio, you have to fill out a form swearing allegiance to that party's principles under penalty of election falsification. Well, we'll follow this one. It could get very interesting. Ellen Ratner joins us now from Talk Radio News Service. She, of course, traveled with Tom to Darfur and wended her way back via Dubai. Ellen, welcome to the Tom Hartman
program. Well, thank you very much. I know Tom's a little under the weather, and I'm expecting to get there soon. But
we'll watch the Weather Channel and see if it moves in over you, Ellen.
Exactly. I want to talk about two things and maybe a third thing if we have time. And one is that Condoleezza Rice called up Senator Obama and apologized for the security breach with his passport. What's so interesting is they also say that it was McCain's files that was also examined. Now, some sort of paranoid Washington people are sort of wondering, well, are they saying it's McCain's as well just to make it look like it wasn't a Democratic thing? But there's a lot of speculation about how this all came down. Of course, this had to do with supposedly some employees that have been now, they fired one or something. But in any case, there's a real talk about whether there was some partisanship in that by some people.
Well, and the story just broke yesterday. I'm waiting for more details before we start to point fingers, because it could have been people who were curious, who thought they might come up with something they could sell on eBay. It may have been politically motivated, and certainly I would suspect Republicans before Democrats in terms of the current State Department population and their interests in either the files of McCain or Obama.
I mean, they apparently were disciplined, and, Peter, it looks as if he said that that Rice said that essentially, you know, Washington Times said that two employees of the department had actually been fired. Mm-hmm. So we'll see what happens on that front. And also, of course, the other big news is the Richardson endorsement of Obama. Now, I happen to know, and I know this is heard in New Mexico, first of all, Richardson is one of the best politicians I've ever encountered. He's competent. He's smart. But he's also looking for something, and he likes being governor. But you know, if Obama is elected, then his governorship ends in 2010. 2009 would be when Obama would be sworn in. So he may be looking for something like Secretary of State. He may want to be vice presidential, but I don't think Obama's going to put him on the ticket. But clearly Clinton...
And why would you say that? Because his diplomatic skills, the posture he took during the campaign as a conciliator among the Democrats, I think he shapes up as an interesting figure, a Southwest state that could be crucial, and, of course, his status as a Democrat Hispanic.
Right. The question is, though, is he either forced to take Hillary Clinton on the ticket by the party somehow, or does he also try and go with some sort of, you know, white guy from the middle of the country or somewhere else, maybe even Massachusetts, because it looks like Massachusetts at this point has McCain very competitive with Obama.
Well, I understand your calculation, and I do agree that it should be someone who can carry a state, a crucial state. And unfortunately, John Edwards doesn't fit that criteria. He's sitting on some delegates that could be helpful to Obama in the race against Clinton right now. But I'm not sure that he, A, wants to run for vice president a second time, or that, B, the Obama team would see him as a guy who could really contribute to delivering some states.
Yeah, that I agree with you. That's going to figure into that. The other there's a ton of other stuff, but one of the things is that Nancy Pelosi has called for world condemnation of the Chinese crackdown in Tibet. So she has registered her concern about that, and she's not a very happy camper.
And
she has a long history of fighting for human rights in China, including all through the 90s, or actually the late 80s through the early 90s, trying annually to deny most favored nation status to China over human rights issues. She was trumped by the Clinton administration in about 1995 on that.
No, she has always been very active about that, probably because of her constituency in San Francisco. And also, Senator Jim Webb of Virginia, also many people are looking at him as a vice presidential possibility. He did an interview with U.S. News, and he said that he believes that Admiral William Fallon, as you know, he was the commander of the U.S. Central Command, was consciously kept away from congressional discussion of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he said that he wants his committee in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and Armed Services to bring Admiral Fallon and to question him under oath.
Well, I think that could be very, very interesting. I'd like to hear Admiral Fallon's comments about the Bush administration's posture toward Iran as well.
Yeah, I think we all would. And
okay.
Under oath, he's going to have to say it.
Well, Ellen, welcome back. Take your vitamin C, your Airborne, whatever works for you, and stay healthy, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Ellen Ratner from Talk Radio News Service. I'm Peter B. Collins. It's been a delight to sit in for Tom Hartman again today. Hopefully, Tom will be back with you on Monday, so tune in and find out. If you'd like to send me an email, do so. It's peter@peterbcollins.com. Thanks for listening, and happy Easter, and Purim greetings to people coast to coast.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.